The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Way of Reality koans. The 13th Daughter's Dharma, main case. When the 13th daughter of the family Cheng was 12, she accompanied a nun to the monastery of Guishan. As the nun was rising from making a bow before the master, Guishan said, "Where do you live?" The nun replied, "I live beside the stream at Nantai." Guishan asked, "Where does that old woman behind you live?" And then told the nun to go. The 13th daughter stepped forward and stood with her arms folded in front of her. Guishan asked the same question again. The 13th daughter said, "I've already presented it to you, Reverence." Guishan said, "Go." As she was walking out from the Dharma hall, the nun said, "The 13th daughter usually says that she knows Chan and that her mouth is quick and sharp. But today she was questioned by the great master Guishan and she didn't have a reply for him at all." The 13th daughter said, "My goodness, how can you talk like that? And you still say you're on a pilgrimage. Take off your patch robe and give it to me." Later, the 13th daughter told the entire story to Lao Shan, saying, "Visiting Guishan, I answered like this. Was my answer correct?" Lao Shan said, "I don't say that there wasn't a mistake." The 13th daughter asked, "Well, what was my mistake?" Lao Shan scolded her. The 13th daughter said, "Adding flowers to brocade." Dharma Roshi's comment, "Stop. Stop talking and contriving, and then the iron tree will bloom, and the stone woman will give birth to a child in the night. Even a nimble lass can lose her footing on a slippery floor. Like the god Achilles, though free in every way, still there's a stumbling place. But say, tell me, where was her heir? If you say there's none, then you miss it. If you say there is an error, then you're 10,000 miles away. If you say there's neither, I'll run you out of here with my stick. What do you say? Speak." The verse, "Fangs bared, claws unsheathed, the lion cub hasn't learned fear. It's not a matter for hesitating over. The head and tail belong to the same lion. Cat barks, dog purrs, the mother load is every mountain." So I wanted to, in marking Dada Roshi's memorial, 15th memorial, and in this month, which follows the month of September, which was the first month when this place began as a training center. Dada Roshi moved in with his then-wife, Yushin, who was here this morning for the service, and their young son, Asian, and their another son, David, and they began practicing. And the Sangha, small though it was, began training. And so I thought of this collection of koans years ago when Dada Roshi was still very active. He started putting together a series of collections that he drew from different sources, some of them from traditional sources that he sort of refigured. The Way of Reality is the name of the monastery, Doshinji, Temple of the Way of Reality. And he wanted to put together, his plan was to put together a collection of koans that spoke specifically to practitioners today. And so it never came to completion. I have, I don't know how many there are, just pages, sort of rough drafts of the koans themselves and his commentary and the capping verse. And he drew them, as I said, from different places. And part of the function, as he said in the commentary to this, which is in the book, Two Errors Meeting in Midair, I think, and the part of what he wanted to do was call from the few sources that there are of women teachers, women practitioners who either showed up in koans or were engaged in dialogues that could be turned into a teaching koan. So this is an example. So for this weekend's intensive, we've been studying bodhicitta, the great aspiration of arousing the intention, the aspiration, the commitment, the vow to alleviate the suffering by enlightening the minds of self and other. Every human being is born, lives, and dies. This is an essential truth. Every person seeks some form of purpose, meaning, contentment. This is a life force that exists within us. Every person lives within a particular time and place, within a culture, a society that influences them, that they are influencing, that guides, that instructs, and basically gives us instruction in how to achieve what is important by the standards of that culture. And every person lives within dukkha throughout their life, samsara, the ongoing cycles of dissatisfaction, seeking, grasping or not grasping what is sought, and then the disappointment of seeing that dissipate and drop away, and then more desire arises, all based in the sense of a self that is existing within us, that is our essence, our soul, our eternal something. And that as soon as that arises within us and gets solidified, then it perceives, that sense of self perceives ourselves as inside this skin bag, and everything outside, this is me, all of this is not me. And then every form of activity that we see in samsara, the seeds are planted for that. Why do some doubt and question that? Some do not. Many perhaps do not. Perhaps most do not. I don't know that study has ever been made. Why do some doubting and questioning begin a search? Some doubt and question, and that's it. Maybe it's something in the forefront of their mind and then it moves back and recedes. Maybe it's always been in the back of their mind, never really brought forward. But for some, it appears, it becomes stronger, and they begin searching. Why do some find something, a path, and engage it, but not continue? So others do. We had a person years ago who practiced here for a long time. I don't think he ever became a student, but he wrote an article for the Mountain Record, said, "Circling the Gate." Circling the Gate. Here we go around again. What are the important questions? The Buddha said through his response, what he talked about, the questions he asked, the questions he did not answer, the important questions are the ones that have a direct bearing on life itself in the deepest way. And so in engaging the Dharma, that is offered to us. We're in a sense, whatever it is that's driving us, whatever it is we feel, whatever it is we think we're searching, whatever clarity or lack of clarity we may have about what we're actually doing in our seeking, when we encounter the Dharma, the teachings present us with those things that are important. Cause and effect, personhood, what we experience inside and outside, how we respond, how we understand things, what we do with our thoughts and words and actions. And what the teachings made clear, what we saw this weekend in the teachings, is that once the bodhi mind, the mind that is seeking, that is turning towards the way, turning towards the path of enlightenment, once that is arisen, it must be raised again and again and again and again. Dogen says, those who think that arousing the aspiration only happens once although practice for attaining one realization happens innumerable times, have not heard, known, or encountered Buddha Dharma. Arousing the aspiration for alignment 1,000 times, 1 billion times, is no other than arousing the aspiration one time. Arousing the aspiration for alignment by 1,000 billion people is none other than arousing one aspiration. Arousing the aspiration for alignment one time is arousing the aspiration 1,000 times, 1 billion times. Practice, realization, and the turning of the Dharma are also like this. Dr. Roshi used to often talk about how practice can seem like circling back around. We raise Bodhi mind, we encounter the Dharma, we begin practicing, we see things shifting and changing, and then suddenly we see something that is very familiar. I thought I had taken care of this. I thought I'd let go of this. I thought I'd move beyond this, but here it is again. And so we can have the sense that we've circled back around and here we are back at the beginning. But he said, no. He said, if we're a sincere practitioner, it's not possible to return to anything. I mean, you don't even have to be a practitioner for that to be true. But the sense of returning to something old that we thought we'd taken care of, he says, no, what's happening is it's more like a spiral. There is a circling back around. We are seeing things again, but we're forever moving forward. We're seeing them differently. We are not the same person. What we see it, how we respond, all of that is in the midst of change. So the 13th daughter of Cheng, that's all we know about her, the 13th daughter, so she had to be scrappy, right? There were 12 of them ahead of her, and she was. And so she comes to Guishan accompanying this nun and has this encounter. And I was thinking of other women monastics and practitioners who also encountered the Dharma very young. I mean, that seems like crazy. It can seem crazy to us, you know, that she would be doing that at that age, but not really. It's not that unusual that people at that young age, sort of at the threshold between childhood, adolescence, and becoming an adult. That's the time, right, when people, a person can begin really seeing and recognizing, oh, that's where I'm headed. They look around at all the other adults in the room. What are their lives like? How are they acting? How is that working out? You know, it's no longer shifting from sort of having those choices made for them, and now it's like, oh, I realize I'm moving towards being that one. That can be a time of great questioning. Zenshin was a young woman born in 6th century. She was 12 years old, and it said, the records say she became Japan's first Buddhist female monastic. Miadao, whose name we chant in our women's lineage, in the 11th century, was 14 when she first asked to be ordained, when she was 14. Her father refused and sent her to work in the palace with her aunt, and she worked there until she was 15. And then she worked from 15 until 20, and at the age of 20, she asked again, and her father said, okay. So she became ordained. Mugai Nyodai, whose name we chant, was in her 40s when she asked to be ordained. So it can happen at various times in a person's life. Young or old, what matters is that it matter. That's what matters, is that it matter. I had thought that during the retreat, the intensive that we were doing on bodhicitta and with Dada Roshi's memorial, it would be nice to invoke some of Dada Roshi's teachings on bodhicitta. So I mentioned that to Shoan, and she mentioned to Sankai, and you went searching and found a couple of short clips from talks and put them into audio files. And then you told me about that, and I went back after lunch with the express purpose of sitting down and listening to them, and I completely forgot. And then I came back, and I thought, well, we'll just play them. I won't have listened to them, but we'll just play them. And then I came back, and just in the midst of the whole afternoon, I forgot again. And Shoan had told me, she said, there are two talks, they're very short, they're both on bodhicitta. One's kind of edgy. So this morning, before I came over, after I sat, I listened to one of them, and I thought, oh, that's the edgy one. And then I listened to the second one, I thought, oh no, that's the edgy one. And edgy in the sense of he was being very strong, as he could very easily be. And he was talking about bodhicitta, about that inquiring mind, the mind that wants to know. And in a very strong way, he could be fierce in his teaching, in his love for the Dharma, in his desire for his students to take this seriously, to not be complacent, he would often be trying to arouse that within us, particularly if he felt like it was not. And I've thought about that, slight digression, about those qualities of his that could be so strong and fierce and demanding, and how, in a very real sense, how well used those were for many years when we were beginning here. When the Sangha who was here, and there were certainly many before I got here in 84, who were all new to the Dharma, were generally, not all, but generally pretty young, oftentimes not a life experience. He used to bemoan that people came out without any work skills. Like, haven't you people done anything that you can apply to here? We need plumbers. We need carpenters. We need electricians, And so it was a little wild and unruly. Nobody really knew what practice was, what practicing within a schedule, what training was. Why do we have to get up so early? Why do we have to bow to the Buddha, for Christ's sake? What's that about? That's not Buddhism. And so not having very little experience with the Dharma doesn't mean that we can't have lots of opinions about it. Right? And so particularly in the early years when people really didn't, there was very little to read, right? It was very hard to get information, particularly if you go to the dictionary, but to get living sort of Dharma and a sense of what training is, that was not so easy to find. And so he was, trying to build a seamless temple in rain and snow and fire and so that strength that he had, that power, that confidence, that ferocity that sometimes he brought to the Dharma was oftentimes very powerful and grounding, right? And of course, any strength can have two sides, right? And so there was that too. He was a demanding teacher. And so in this talk, he was literally saying, if you're here and you're just screwing around, you're wasting your time, and you're wasting my time, his time, right? And he was trying to do was arouse, right? It was another way of saying, there's something going on here, not just here. There's something going on in this world, in your life, and it's happening. Do you see that? The Buddha said, there's a house on fire. Do we know that, actually? Do we feel the heat of that? One would think that within the midst of a house on fire, everybody would know. And they'd get the hell out, right? And in the Lotus Sutra, that exact story is told about how children playing with their toys in the burning house don't want to leave because they're having too much fun with their toys. So sometimes to have that kind of directness, to sort of startle us, wake us up. So the 13th daughter comes, and the nun that she's accompanying, because she's not ordained, the nun bows to the master, and Guishan says, "Where do you live?" And she says, "Oh, I live by the stream at Nantai." And Guishan says, "Go." "And who's that old woman standing behind you?" Da Roshi, in his commentary on this, says, "This 12-year-old daughter of Cheng was obviously extraordinary. Can you imagine it? Most 12-year-olds these days would want to watch television or hang out at the mall." It's a little dated. Seems kind of quaint, right? If only. This one is doing pilgrimage all over China with a fellow monastic. She goes to say Kueshan, goes to see Kueshan living on his mountain somewhere in the deep recesses of China, an isolated region where the monastics couldn't even go begging and the community had to raise buffalo and cattle for their own food to survive. The journey must have been long and dangerous. Cheng's daughter had to have a strong spiritual drive. Evidently, she practiced and has some understanding. She reminds me of Ling Chao, the daughter of Layman Peng, one of the more renowned lay practitioners in the history of Zen. Ling Chao, from a very early age, was close to her, was very clear in her grasp of the Dharma. Although both her mother and father were deeply enlightened, she was the clearest. The three of them would do Dharma encounter at the dinner table or while working in the fields. And so recognizing that there's something, is something extraordinary about this young person. And she also knows it. How do you use that now? And so he says, "What about this old woman?" Well, the nun says, "I live beside the stream at Nantai," which is an honest answer. She answers from that place that we identify as our home, this body, this mind, this place where the body and mind are standing, where it sleeps, where it wakes up, the place we come from, the place we return to. She's not wrong. Guishan says, "Go." And then, "Who is that old woman behind you?" She's 12 years old. Why old woman? Did he see something in her that was not 12 years old? Maybe something like an ancient mirror. And so Guishan asks her, "Where do you live?" And she stepped forward and crossed her arms. And Guishan asked again, "Where do you live?" And she says, "Your reverence, I've already told you." And he said, "Go." A student was asked, "Master Dongshan, you're sick, teacher. You're ill. Is there anyone who is not sick?" Dongshan said, "Yes, there is." And the student said, "Does the one who is not ill look after you?" And Dongshan said, "I actually have the opportunity to look after them." And the student says, "How is it when you look after them?" Dongshan said, "Then I don't see any illness." "You are here, sister. Is there one who is not here?" "Yes, there is." "Does the one who is not here look after them?" "Does the one who is not here look after you?" "I actually have the opportunity to look after them." "How is it when you look after them?" "I don't see the one who is here." Somebody looking for at a distance, standing in the room, would say, "You're right here. This is where you are. This moment, just this moment, nowhere but here." What is her expression? What is her answer to the teacher? She stands and crosses her arms. What we practice in Zazen so often is, don't fly away. Don't fly away. Even when it seems like you must, or it's the right thing to do, or it's what you've always done, it's what we know best, or it's too hot to stay here, don't fly away. As we see into our delusion, don't attach to that delusion. As Dogen said, don't take it lightly, but don't add weight. Don't detest that delusion, and cherish the enlightenment that you see up ahead. As we begin to develop and our lives begin to transform, don't attach to that. Don't take that lightly, but don't give that weight either. Don't cherish that and dislike the delusion that you think you're leaving behind. Dada Roshi says, raise your aspiration now again. Dogen says, raise it again, 100 times, 1,000 times, 100 billion times. What is that? It's beginning again. It's remembering. It's returning to our original intention. It's remembering to be clear about what we're doing, why we're here. So in a moment where other things become great important, and I don't mean important things, when we become competitive, judgmental, critical, opinionated, doubting, blaming, and we give that lots of fuel, and that becomes bigger. And that's what our zazen is. Raise bodhicitta. I remember in my early years, and that can mean lots of years. It's code. It can mean as many years as there may be. You know, and with the responsibilities that I had, you know, oftentimes I would come into the Zendo with lots of things on my mind, lots of things that needed to be done, lots of things that were undone. And I would sit and I would turn to my practice, and then I would keep going to those things, going to those things. And there was a part of me that thought, you know, these are my responsibilities. I need to take care of them. They're important. People are depending on that. And so I would kind of sanction my distraction. I would justify it. I would give it validity. This is how I take care of the Dharma. This is how I take care of the Sangha. Isn't that good? Aren't I good for doing that? And there is a point at which I realize this is not what I'm supposed to be doing right now. This is not fulfilling my responsibility. My responsibility now to myself and the Sangha is that I'm doing zazen. That's what I'm here to do. That's what I should be doing. And I sort of saw through, kind of punctured that bubble, that illusion that I was using to indulge what was just honestly hard to let go of. That's really what was happening. It was hard to let go of. I kept getting mired in it, so I thought, well, let's just make that the thing I'm supposed to be doing, right? Then you're doing great, right? Don't fly away. Don't attach to this, don't attach to that. That's the great challenge in Buddhadharma. And that whatever comes along, even if what we've realized is emptiness, there is not a thing. All attachments are forms of delusion. Then we attach to that. Or we attach to being the person who has had insight into enlightenment or emptiness. Or we attach to putting on a gray robe, or attached to doing Jhikkhaya. Dada Roshi used to really emphasize that a lot in the beginning because there weren't that many people. You told the story recently of when you looked at somebody who was a Jikido when you first got here and you thought they were just about to become a teacher, right? I remember, you know, same thing when I saw somebody be a senior student. There were very few senior students. And I thought, oh my God. They're like, just, they're right at the threshold. They're going to be a teacher like tomorrow. You know, it was very hard to hold things sort of in their proper perspective. So Guishan asked her, she folded her arms, and then he asked her again, what are you saying? What are you showing me? What do you understand? A probing question. And she says, I've already told you. And Dada Roshi's footnote to that is, ah, too much, too soon, too fast, too bad. I remember when he said that, and I thought, oh, you are enjoying this so much. You love that. It does have a ring to it. He said, still, it amounts to something. I'll keep my eyes on the horizon and watch, which he said was saying, you have something. I'll keep my eyes open and look for you. But Guishan said, go. He saw a bright light. And because he saw a bright light, it was even more important to not make a fuss. It's like when you first light a fire, right? You have to be very careful about how you tend to it. If you tend it too strongly, you'll snuff it out. He said, go. He saw her, not just her insight, but her spirit, her confidence, and he realized he could trust that she would develop well. He could also see her pride, her arrogance. But trusting the Dharma, when somebody has bodhicitta, when somebody is really wanting to realize themselves to be clear, when pride and arrogance arise, or when insecurity and doubt arise, they will arise and they will have strength. And they can pull a person in, and the person can indulge them, and they begin to wander away from their original intention. But because that is not their core aspect, that's not what they're actually seeking. They're not coming to the Dharma because they want to be a Dharma king or queen. They're not coming because they want to win the race and be the first one to cross. That, because that is not their aspiration, when they wander into that realm within themselves, at some point they will remember. If that is what they're looking for, there is nothing to remember because they're getting what they wanted. That's why establishing a clear intention is so important. And then again, it's like a keel on a boat. A rudder is what guides you. Tack, right or left. A keel is what keeps you upright. Right? It's like a weight. So that when the wind pushes, the boat can turn. It's not rigid, because then the mast will snap. It has to bend. It bends within its various influence, but the keel keeps it upright from wandering, from going too far. However, if the wind is too great, it can turn over. But it can be righted. And so if we think of aspiration that way, then we don't have to be afraid of our humanity. We don't have to be afraid of getting lost. It's easy to get lost, first of all. Everybody does, whether for a period of zazen, a few moments, a day, a month, 10 years. That doesn't take a lot of skill, getting lost. What takes skill is finding our way back. And those skills are precious indeed. How do we develop those skills? By getting lost. By wandering in to the self, to our kleshas, to our attachments. And so Guishan saw this in her and had confidence. You know, that's part of what a trusting teacher is to do, is, you know, that I would see my teacher work with students in different ways. And particularly when he, you know, had close contact with the teacher, he was living with them, or that, you know, he could respond to them and then see, where do they go now? What do they do with this? Dogen says, you now encounter the Tathagata's teaching and appear to clarify matters. You may not yet understand the entire teachings, though. Those of you who study should not be proud of yourselves. And there's a very interesting dynamic that as we practice, we are hopefully developing confidence and a kind of strength, a true strength, and ability to guide ourselves more and more, but to have that not turn into arrogance and pride. That basic confidence becomes an object, a prize, a reward, a jewel. That's why you know, what I said yesterday, that the genuine practice of compassion, I think I said, is an ass kicker. Is that the term I use? It's a traditional Buddhist term. And what I really meant is it's humbling. We are humbled. I am humbled in the presence of my own delusion, of others' delusions, of the collective delusion within a group, within a nation, between nations, humbled by my desire to want to do something that will be a benefit, humbled by the magnitude of the task. As the 13th daughter was walking away, the nun said, "You've always said that you know Chan and that your mouth is quick and sharp. But today you were questioned by the great Master Guishan and you didn't have a reply for him at all." And she says, "My goodness, how you talk. Take off your robe and give it to me. What are you doing wearing a robe of the way?" All things are non-dual. So within confidence, when that is endowed with the self, when it is not yet fully clear, it can very easily flip into arrogance. A great spirit can also become pride. And so our confidence or arrogance can also be insecurity and self-doubt. And so to liberate those unhelpful qualities from the self, or to liberate the self from those aspects, we do that as they arise. So when you're practicing and suddenly you see pride arise, you don't have to be afraid of it. It's just a sense of something, right? The interaction of feeling and response, we talked about that. Right, in the repetitiveness of that. So when that arises again and again, and we believe in it, yeah, that's me. Dada Roshi used to often say, don't believe in your own press notices. Right? Everybody else is, I mentioned, you know, we were coming in from lunch one day after the end of a Sunday, you know, a long, I don't know what the week was, but I could see that he was, you know, a little bit tired. And somebody came up and says, "Roshi, what is it like to be so adored by your Sangha?" And he looked at me and said, "Depressing." We don't have to be afraid of it. We just see it. Oh, I know you. I know you. And then you return to where you are. You return to what's important. And if the pride persists, it's like, oh, you want to come along? You can come along, but I'm not giving you any vital energy. I'm not giving you my life force, right? But you can come along if you insist. And then, because I'm not giving that attention, it will get tired and bored and leave. And then she goes to this other master and tells this story and says, "Where was my mistake? Did I make a mistake? Was my answer correct?" And the teacher says, "Well, I don't say that you didn't make a mistake." And she wants to know, "Well, what was it?" And then he scolds her. Why doesn't he tell her? She's asking. "You said this. It meant that. You should have said this." He just scolded her. He left her with her self. He trusted her. He could see that she would see for herself because she had that spirit, because she had bodhicitta. She had traveled all of these distances. She was asking, yes, there was pride, but there was more than that, much more than that. And those doubts, her asking, can be looking outside of oneself, asking for somebody else to recognize, confirm, am I okay? But it can also be healthy and natural to go seeking. Dogen said, often the reasoning behind bodhisattvas losing their aspiration is that they haven't met authentic teachers or the Dharma. If we don't hear the Dharma, what do we follow? What is our guide? If we don't listen to the Dharma, then how will we understand, be guided in what is important? What should I be focusing on? What are the things that I should be reflecting on, that I should be contemplating? What are the deep and difficult aspects of my humanity, of humanity at large, of the world, of dukkha, that need examination, right? To understand, we put so much energy into studying and researching and learning all kinds of wonderful things that are very useful. We need to do the same thing if we want to understand, be that inner astronaut that Robert Thurman talked about, then we have to actually examine. And there are ways that are doing that directly without thinking. And there are ways that are doing that with using the power of our discerning mind. Even a nimble lass can lose footing on a slippery floor. Stumbling is called finding one's way in the path. It can be called wholehearted activity. Stumbling can be, and how we respond to that can be an expression of fearlessness, resilience. It's called bodhicitta. Fangs bared, claws unsheathed, the lion cub hasn't learned fear. It's not a matter for hesitating over. The head and tail belong to the same lion. The falling and the rising, the doubting and the confidence, the turning in and turning out, getting lost, finding our way back, all belongs to the same lion. And because it includes everything, cats bark, dogs purr, all the way through the mother lode is every mountain. May all living beings uninterruptedly hear the sweet sound of Dharma. May governments rule in accordance with Dharma, and may the people of the world prosper. From a distance, one could think this is just dreaming. This is like just bringing forth false hope, living in a fantasy world. It is dreaming. It is dreaming. We dream ourselves asleep all the time. If we're going to dream, and there are dreams, and there are dreams within dreams, the Buddha spent his whole teaching life in a dream. And he was teaching us how to dream ourselves awake. So if we're going to dream, and we are master dreamers, we should dream a true dream, a real dream, that is not just a fantasy, but is really the expression of Buddha nature, of our true nature. Listening to some people who live in Western North Carolina, Tennessee, Florida, who've lost everything. And they recount that, and they say, yes, I've lost everything, but you know what's extraordinary? Is how people have come together. Our neighbors I didn't even know, didn't even know their name, are coming to help. Every day is the best of times and the worst of times. To see what we are made of and to live that is bodhicitta.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.